welcome, welcome, welcome to tonight's CCL training. It's on how the carbon fee is assessed and collected. This weekly webinar program is for CCL supporters to help empower all of us to be more aware and more effective climate advocates, and we really appreciate you taking the time tonight to join us. Our esteemed speaker to take us through this webinar tonight is none other than the wonderful Rick Knight. Rick's mission as CCL's research coordinator is to work with Vice President of Legislation and Research, Danny Richter, and independent experts to strengthen CCL's science, technology, and policy fundamentals. Rick's portfolio includes updating and maintaining all of our laser talks, our white papers, and managing analytical projects that help all of our volunteers perform at their very best. Prior to joining CCL, Rick completed a 40-year career in energy and pollution control research at the Gas Technology Institute, retiring in 2016 as an institute engineer. And Rick has also been one of CCL's first members in the Chicago area back in 2011 and helped found the Chicago Southwest chapter in 2012, and is also still juggling the state coordinator role for that state. So plenty of opportunities to find out about the intersections that Rick's life enriches all of us with here tonight. If we've done our jobs well, everyone will be walking away with the following three learning goals. We're really hoping to help everyone gain a deeper understanding behind the supply chain of the fossil fuel industry, how that intersects with this fee assessment. We're really going to explore how HR 763, or the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, connects with CCL's early advocacy for the placement of the carbon fee, as well as how it differs, and really explore how HR 763 directs the implementation of this policy, and really explore that difference in the language of the actual bill text. So to get us there, our agenda is pretty straightforward. Rick's going to do a quick policy review and background. We're going to talk about measurement and what it means when we say upstream and downstream. We're going to examine a lot of the supply chain pathways for coal, oil, and natural gas. We'll talk specifically about the legislative text in HR 763 and what it discusses with the fee placement, and then really close with focusing on what does regulatory discretion entail with this bill. And again, thank you so much for being on the light tonight, Rick.
Thank you very much, Brett, and welcome everybody from me. You may have heard that the carbon fee and dividend, and now the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, is being supported by a three-legged stool. And these legs are the carbon fee, the carbon dividend, and the border adjustment. So each of these legs have to be strong enough to hold up its end. And tonight we're going to take a closer look at this one, the carbon fee. And we'll start by reviewing the basic structure of the policy. So the basic structure of the carbon fee, actually it's a carbon dioxide fee, but collected before the carbon actually gets burned, it's imposed on the big three fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. The fee goes up every year pretty aggressively and goes into a carbon fund. And then, of course, that money is then recycled back into the economy as household dividends. But how exactly is the fee placed on the fuel? That's what we're focusing on today. When we talk about a carbon fee, the first question to ask is, what is it that gets measured? Well, carbon, of course. But how that relates to the fee is not quite what you might think. The fee is actually based on the carbon dioxide equivalent, or CO2e, for the fuel in question. That term means the amount of CO2 plus other greenhouse gases that are normally generated when the fuel is burned. If we know the percent of carbon in the fuel, we know how much CO2e it will produce. Every ton of carbon will produce between 3.67 and 3.69 tons of CO2e. It varies slightly with this kind of fuel. And as I'll show you a little later, all coal, oil, or natural gas is analyzed for its percent carbon at some point along the way from the source to the buyer. So then the only other thing needed is the metric tons of the fossil fuel. So a metric ton is 1,000 kilograms, or about 2,205 pounds, and the shorthand for it that we use is MT. So when you see MT, it's metric tons. So the amount of money that the seller has to pay to the carbon trust fund is the metric tons multiplied by the percent carbon times the CO2e for that kind of fuel, times the carbon fee rate at the time. How many dollars per metric ton? Now, let's look a little more closely at what this means for each kind of fuel. These, of course, are coal, oil, and gas. And I'll show you how they compare in their carbon, in the amount of CO2 equivalent they produce. I'll also talk about their energy content, because that turns out to be really important when you see how the carbon fee affects their usage. And I'll show you the market price of each fuel, and then what happens to that price when you put a carbon fee on each one. So here's the approximate amount of carbon in each of these fuels. And here's how much CO2 equivalent each one produces from a metric ton of fuel. So you might be thinking, coal is the lowest here, so why is coal so bad for global warming? Well, you'll see in a minute. First, look at how much energy each fuel contains in a metric ton. This is in megawatt hours, which we usually think of as applying to electricity, but it can be used to measure heat content as well. Now, here's the approximate market price for these different fuels. A metric ton of this type of coal goes for about $15. Now, for oil, if you convert barrels to metric tons, it's about $500 a metric ton. And for gas, the price goes up and down with the weather, but on average, it's about $150 a metric ton. Now, here's how much a $15 carbon fee, $15 a metric ton, the first year carbon fee, would add to that price per ton. So even though this kind of coal, widely used in power plants, has the least carbon of these fuels, it takes the biggest percentage price increase. Adding $26 to a ton almost triples the price of coal. Now, looking at oil, that $48 only adds about 10% to the price. And natural gas gets hit with a price increase of about 25%. Well, one more thing. Look at the price increase based on energy. Now you can see why coal is the most affected by the carbon fee. And gas is the least affected, because it gives you the most energy per ton. So when you consider electricity, that's a fight between coal, gas, and renewables. Very little oil is used for generating electricity. So these prices mean that gas will, of course, win out in competition with coal. But renewables and nuclear power will grow even faster than gas, because they have zero carbon, so they don't take any hit from the fee. And of course, electricity is only part of the picture. Oil is used mainly in transportation, and gas is widely used for heating. So since those involve a big markup for the consumer, it takes a little longer for the carbon fee to have an impact with those fuels. Mainly through long-term purchase decisions like vehicles and furnaces and so on. So this should all help you visualize how the carbon fee affects these fuels. Now I want to talk about two terms that are also important to understand in the context of imposing the fee. These are upstream and downstream. Imposing the fee upstream, that means close to the source of the fuel, where the carbon enters the U.S. economy, near the mine or the well or at the port of entry. The advantage of an upstream imposition of the fee is that it captures greenhouse gas emissions from all stages of the supply chain after that, from production all the way to refining, all the way to the consumer. A downstream fee, on the other hand, which means imposing it close to the end use of the fuel, where the energy is consumed, it would be like at the electric meter or the gas meter, or even in the power plant, or in the case of gasoline, at the pump. The disadvantage of a downstream fee is that it would normally include only CO2 emissions from combustion of the fuel, not all the stuff that gets emitted at the refinery or all the way back up to the well or the mine. And these can be considerable, as much as 20% of the total emissions. Now, of course, the fee could include a surcharge to include those, but then there would be no incentive for the producers to reduce those upstream emissions. And there's another reason to impose the fee upstream, which I'll show you in a few more minutes. I want to say a few things more on measurement, which also impacts how the HR 763 policy would be implemented. When a thing is being measured just for scientific knowledge, you want to be as accurate as possible, of course, but when there's a price attached to it, that's a different matter entirely. That requires a degree of rigor and certainty beyond what you would need just for knowledge gathering. So what's easy to measure for purposes of imposing a carbon fee? Well, fuels that are sold from one party to another, because they both have a vested interest in accuracy. It's a financial transaction, so both parties have to agree that the measurement, for example, the amount of oil and the quality, that measurement is accurate. Other emissions that may already be reported to the EPA, facilities like refineries, are obligated by law to measure and report their emissions. And these measurements must be done using strictly certified methods and calibrations. So if those data are already there, one could theoretically use them to track the amount of emissions that are emitted to the atmosphere. Now, on the other hand, what's hard to measure for a carbon fee? Sporadic or unattributable leakage, mainly of methane in the United States. Sporadic means it's unpredictable or chaotic due to changing conditions or equipment breakdowns. Unattributable means emissions that could be coming from any one of several sources or even natural sources, so it's impossible to figure out exactly who's responsible. It doesn't mean these sources should be ignored, but just that direct measurement may not be feasible. Another category that's hard to assess a fee, safety-driven emergencies resulting in leakage. If somebody needs to vent a tank because there's some dangerous situation, it would be considered sporadic. But with the added constraint, you don't want to create an incentive to compromise worker or public safety in order for somebody to avoid having to pay a carbon fee. We know that a lot of industrial accidents come from trying to save money, and we don't want to add to that incentive. And finally, emissions from abandoned sources where the responsible party has dissolved or disappeared and there's no one available to pay the fee. This is like the Superfund sites where companies responsible for land contamination are long gone and the government is left holding the bag. So a carbon fee may not be the optimal solution for these situations. Now let's look at supply chains and what they can tell us about imposing the fee. First up is coal. The arrows show the flow of coal and its products, and I'm showing the raw fuel in black and the final energy products in white. So coal comes out of the mine, along with a lot of rocks and dirt and water. That's called run-of-mine coal. It gets weighed and analyzed, which tells us the amount of carbon, and then goes to a preparation plant where it's crushed, dried, and cleaned up so it's suitable for burning. From there, it gets loaded into rail cars and shipped to customers, which mainly are power plants, but also smaller users like steel mills and manufacturers who burn it for heat. A fair amount of coal is also exported. Finally, the end products, mostly electricity or things like steel and or other metals, those things go to consumer products. Now, a part of the decision-making for where the carbon fee is assessed depends on how many of these transacting entities have to be dealt with. There are about 850 coal mines, around 500 prep plants, 600 power plants and steel mills, but millions of consumers. So the first three are roughly equivalent, but what we want to do is impose the fee as far upstream as practical. So it makes sense to impose the fee at this way feeder, located between the mine and the prep plant. It's a device that weighs the coal while it's moving from one place to another, and where the buyer learns how much coal they're buying from the seller. Now, let's look at oil. Here things get a little more complicated. There are many hundreds of thousands of wells that connect to various sized pipelines. At certain points between these pipelines and the receiving refineries are located special devices called lease automatic custody transfer, or LACT meters. That's where the oil flow and density are measured, which correlates well with the carbon content. So essentially, this is generally the first point of sale, because it's being transferred from the leaseholder to the first buyer. Further downstream is the refinery, where the oil is processed into fuels and chemicals. The fuel products, gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, and others, are shipped by truck, train, or barge to consumers, which would be gas stations, truck terminals, airports, and so on. Now, back at the well, some of them also collect what they call associated gas. So it's natural gas comes out of the well, and they send it on to the natural gas industry, and I'll show you where that ends up. And at the same time, refineries also take in some liquids from the gas industry, some liquid hydrocarbons that are recovered in gas wells. Now, some of the refined products down here, they don't get burned, so they will be entitled to a refund at some point in the chain, because that they're not emitting CO2 to the atmosphere. And of course, some products may be exported. So how is this case different from coal? Well, first of all, there are a lot more oil wells than there are coal mines. So it's impractical to assess a fee at every single one. The LACT meters are already set up to measure everything needed to quantify carbon, so it makes sense that the fee could be assessed at that point, since those data are recorded and reported to the leaseholders and to state and local taxing authorities, and of course to the buyers. But there's also imported oil. So since oil is pretty much the only fossil fuel we import, the amount and composition of the imported crude oil will be specified on the shipper's manifest. There may be some spot checking, but in essence, the data needed to assess the fee will be available at the port of entry. Now, on to natural gas. This supply chain looks a lot like oil. Lots of wells feed into lots of pipelines. Instead of LACT meters, there are these metering skids that basically do the same thing. They measure and analyze the gas in support of the sale. Instead of refineries, the gas is cleaned up at what are called processing plants. And then the pipeline quality gas goes into high pressure interstate transmission pipelines and then on to low pressure distribution systems or to businesses, homes, or directly to the growing number of power plants that burn natural gas. So you can also see here where the gas producers also recover these gas liquids that they send to the oil refineries. So there's some interaction between these different industry, and the associated gas from the oil wells come to the processing plants. So all of these things have to be measured. The numbers look a lot like they do for oil. Lots of wells, about a tenth as many metering stations, and a few hundred processing plants. So the logic of where to assess and where to impose the fee looks similar. The logical point of assessment is here at the metering skid, the first point of sale. Now at this point, I have to give a shout out to CCL's Team Oil. They're one of CCL's action teams that knows this industry inside and out. And that's important for us, because even though we're all environmentalists who want to see fossil fuel utilization go down, we still have to work with that industry. And I've worked with them over the last couple of years to produce a point of assessment working paper, which you can find on their community page if you want to learn more about what I've just showed you. So with all that in mind, it's time to look at what's in the bill and how it relates to all this. So here's what HR 763 contains that relates to fee placement, starting with definitions. That's an extremely important section of any bill. And in this legislation, it's section 9901. For imposing the fee, I'll just focus on five key definitions that I pulled out of that list. Greenhouse gas content, covered fuel, covered entity, upstream greenhouse gas emissions, and full fuel cycle greenhouse gas emissions. It's a tongue twister. Greenhouse gas content defines the meaning of CO2 equivalent for legislative purposes, so the basis for the fee is clear. Covered fuel names crude oil, natural gas, or coal, but also specifies any product derived therefrom that shall be used so as to emit greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Now, this is in here to make sure that anything made from fossil fuel can't evade the fee. Now, the term covered entity spells out refinery, coal mine, pipeline gas supplier, importer of any of the fuels, but also includes this broad, what I'd call fill-in-the-blanks category, which says any entity or class of entities which is transporting, selling, or otherwise using a covered fuel in a manner which emits a greenhouse gas to the atmosphere and which has not been covered by the carbon fee. Something all the lawyers out there, I'm sure, will enjoy. But what it means, this is where the imposition of the fee can be moved much further upstream, because it gives a broad discretion to categorizing something as a covered entity. Now, the upstream greenhouse gas emissions are also defined as greenhouse gases emitted to the atmosphere resulting from, non-exclusively, the extraction, processing, transportation, financing, or other preparation of a covered fuel for use. This very dense legal language is meant, like the last one, to plug any loopholes which could help someone evade the fee and to cover as much as possible of those emissions. And finally, full fuel cycle greenhouse gas emissions simply combines the greenhouse gas content defined back here with the upstream greenhouse gas emissions. So it adds them together. And it turns out to be really important for both the carbon fee and the border adjustment, which we're not going to go into, but it needs to equalize the fees imposed in all cases so we can be in compliance with World Trade Organization rules. And so that's why it has to be covered in both cases. Now, the next section that I want to look at is the carbon fee section of the bill. This lays out the imposition of the fee and the amount and rate, and I'll explain what the difference is in a moment, plus the inflation adjustment. So under the imposition of the fee, this section imposes it on any covered entities emitting use, sale, or transfer of a covered fuel for an emitting use. It's intended to cover emissions not only from power plants or cars, but those process emissions at the refineries or gas processing plants. And note that together with the broad definition of a covered entity, this allows the agency to designate any entity that sells, transports, or otherwise uses a covered fuel in a way that emits greenhouse gases. Now, in the next box, this may seem a little weird, but the bill distinguishes between the amount of fee and the rate. The amount simply designates the calculation which the greenhouse gas content multiplied by the rate, and the rate is the dollar amount of the fee. As we all know, it's $15 per metric ton in the first year, followed by $10 more each succeeding year, except if the emissions targets are not met, which would cause it to ratchet up to $15 each succeeding year until they do come under those targets. So that's spelled out in this section. And finally, the inflation adjustment, which incidentally was not in the 2018 bill, is now included. Carbon fee amounts, in addition to the annual $10 rate increase, will be also escalated by applying a cost of living adjustment relative to the year 2018. So however many years pass, whatever the inflation rate builds up to be, that will be applied to the total fee. And this is really important so that the fee doesn't become ineffective as the years go by and the cost of living goes up. So we made sure to add that. Now, one more section. This is section 9907, Administrative Authority. And I divide it into three broad areas. Prescribe regulations for imposing the fee, identify the point of assessment, and establish two governing directives. So let me explain those. First of all, the bill is written to give the Treasury, in consultation with the EPA, the authority to write, or the word they use is prescribe, the rules that must be followed. It gives them authority to identify the covered entities, establish a way to collect monthly payments from those entities. So the payments are monthly, not just the dividends. And to distinguish between how the fees are assessed for the different fuels. And also to distinguish between greenhouse gas content and upstream emissions. So this means that they can prescribe methods to assess the carbon in each fuel separately from assessing upstream emissions, if that's necessary. Now, the second thing I carved out of here is that the legislation directs the Treasury to identify, quote, an effective point in the production, distribution, or use of a covered fuel for collecting such carbon fee. And in it includes both regulations and guidance. Now, we're way in the weeds here, I know, but what this means is that although regulations have to go through a lengthy formal process, guidance doesn't require that. That's just directives that can be issued at any time to quickly respond to changing circumstances. And finally, what does an effective point mean? That's in this last box with two governing directives, I should say. The first is to minimize administrative burden, and the second is to maximize the extent to which full fuel cycle greenhouse gas emissions are hit with the fee. So this leaves the regulators to figure out where exactly the fee is most efficiently imposed to hit the sweet spot for both of these. We don't want them to spend 5 years trying to figure this out. So that's why we want to minimize administrative burden, but we want to get as much of the emissions as you can. The point of this is we want this legislation to start reducing greenhouse gas emissions as aggressively as possible, but also as quickly as possible. So the bill does not spell it out, but at this time, we, CCL, believe the first custody transfer with the carbon flow measured by the devices we've identified is probably going to be optimal. As for emissions not captured by the carbon measurement, that may require regulators to go a little deeper into things like fugitive emissions, flaring, and other upstream emissions, which I mentioned here in this first box. So now a few more words about regulatory discretion. Some may worry that leaving so much up to cabinet departments could allow a future administration that is hostile to this climate policy to weaken it or undermine the program. They should take comfort in the fact that the foundational authority of the government to regulate greenhouse gases is unchanged by this bill. So it's still there for the courts to use as a basis for adjudicating any challenges or any changes. There's also a guardrail because legislative intent is clear, and the courts are very loath to allow regulators to undermine the intent of Congress when the legislation was first written. And finally, even if a future administration wants to undo regulations, the changes must be justified and follow a process that involves a period of public comment and allow for court challenges. We've seen this play out in the last 2 years where the current administration is trying to undo regulations but hasn't actually succeeded in most cases. Once all the boxes have been checked, the policy is pretty resistant to being scuttled. And furthermore, once the market forces have been set in motion, they tend to take on a life of their own, and it's very hard to reverse such a massive transition that could be underway over the period of a few years. So with that, I'll just summarize. H.R. 763 leaves a lot up to regulatory discretion. This is pretty routine in legislation, because trying to cram everything into a bill with all the formalized procedures necessary to pass it and get all these folks in Congress to vote for it, it means nothing would ever pass if you tried to put everything in a bill. That's why we have cabinet departments and agencies full of experts to interpret and implement the laws. And in this case, it's the Treasury Department in consultation with the EPA, which is designating this bill as the secretary and the administrator, for those of you who want to actually read it. A key directive for imposing the fee is to minimize administrative burden and maximize effectiveness, and I went into that. Now, CCL's research on this helps provide guidance to legislators and regulators as the policy moves through the gauntlet to being implemented. This is why we want to understand the industry. We can't let our eagerness to make fossil fuels go away dissuade us from deep understanding of the industry this legislation seeks to regulate. It's wise to take advantage of existing infrastructure, such as those LACT meters and other resources that already exist, and also to leverage existing business and compliance practices to the extent possible. The more expertise CCL can develop in these areas, the more effectively we can steer the outcome.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Rick. If you have any questions after tonight, I'm going to put my email in the chat window as well. You can get a hold of me at brett@citizensclimate.org. And Rick Knight's email is featured here. You can get a hold of Rick at rick.knight@citizensclimatelobby.org. You're also more than welcome to ask any questions. In fact, we encourage it just because chances are people have also been asking the same thing. You can see the ongoing dialogue if you search for the Energy Innovation Act Forum. And you can see that URL here is listed as well. It's just cclusa.org/Energy Innovation Act Forum with dashes in between. But I would like to just close with this quote. And simply because the only success that we have seen as an organization is due to you. You are the ones that have made all of the progress possible, and I hope that all of you feel empowered in these opportunities to really go out and, you know, be more articulate or more grounded in what we're trying to accomplish together. So here is to you. This is from a new CCL volunteer after last year's year-end appeal, and here's what they had to say, celebrating all of your work. With the introduction of the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act in the House of Representatives, we have a historic opportunity to take bold action to ensure a stable climate and livable world for future generations. Now is indeed the time, and thank you all for being on the line tonight and making this possible.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.